Our next guest on Downtown is an actor, comedian, writer, and founding member of the comedy troupe Kids in the Hall. He is off on a solo tour telling stories, no jokes, stories, at City Wineries in Boston on the 17th of July, New York on the 19th, Philadelphia, and many more. We're pleased to be joined on Downtown by Kevin McDonald. First of all, this is it's a bit of a reunion of sorts. Carrie, my co-host, saw your show and met you briefly down in New Orleans a while back.
Oh, hi.
Hi, yeah, the performance you did at the Big Couch, which was a great evening. That was really a lot of fun.
Thank you for lying. It was very disappointing. I thought it was very disappointing. I had just done like a lot of shows that did well, and that was they were on my side and stuff, but anyway, that was very sweet of you to lie. Thank you very much.
He's been doing that to me for years. Tell us about this City Winery tour that will bring you to Boston on July 17th, New York, Philadelphia, and every city winery worth going to, apparently.
Apparently. I'm doing stand-up. I can't call anything else. It's not quite a one-man show, and it's not... Stand-up to me means jokes. I can't sell jokes, but I guess it's under the guise of stand-up. I'm doing stories. I tell stories, and I'm silly, and I tell stories, all based on true stories. Well, the true stories I'm telling are based on true stories.
I saw an interview where you said that you're not great at telling jokes. You found that out the hard way, but telling stories is absolutely different.
Yes, I've always been able to tell stories. I always, my grandfather on his deathbed, I'm exaggerating, wasn't his deathbed, but the year before he died, he said, "You're good at telling." I'm not doing an impression of him, but he sounded way younger than I do now, but I'll do a, you have this way of telling stories. You know what's good about them. And then he died 7 months later.
Is there a commonality between your sketch writing and stuff and the storytelling? Is that why the storytelling comes a little more naturally?
Yes. In fact, thanks for reminding me. That's the thing I forgot I was going to say. I forget things a lot now. It's sort of like a sketch version of stand-up. I was going to say that before you brought it up. You sweet liar from New Orleans. New Orleans. Don't say Eanes. They get mad. But yes. It is a sketch version of stand-up, because I'm sort of like acting out some of the parts. Sometimes I say things the other people say to me, and it's like a sketch show. Because I was having trouble doing stand-up. I guess you guys read this. It's so famous. Like before COVID, if Kids in the Hall fans were there, I'd be okay. And if they weren't, if they just came because the club was famous and you just go to see that club on Saturday night, then sometimes I would have trouble. And I somehow figured it out during COVID. So COVID was a good thing. That's my point. I'm kidding, God.
Now, the unimpeachable source that is Wikipedia claims, so I have to ask if this is true, that the college professor who encouraged you to try improv was the guy that many of us know as the smoking man from The X-Files?
Yes. What, do you have his name? Does Wikipedia have his name? I forget.
I think it's William Davis. I think it was.
That's
his name.
It. Yeah. That's it. We called him Bill Davis. But yeah. But I guess his actor is Canadian for SAG. I guess his actor name is Bill Davis. So, yeah. Because he was my performance teacher, and we improvised sometimes in his class. My actual improv class, I failed. I had to fail three classes, and the guy in my improv class hated me, and he had me in two, and his wife had me in dance. I can't dance, but to fail me, I had to try harder than everyone. Anyway, I failed an improv, but the improv I did in performance was, I failed an improv because the Jim Petty, his last name is P-E-T-T-Y. He hated me because I fell asleep, and he hated because I kept doing comedy in my improv, and he wanted drama. Like I remember the first scene was, the first game we ever played in the first week was, it wasn't really a game, wasn't fun. That you would be doing an improv and halfway through something would change your lives. And I now call this the phone call kind of improv because nobody was good enough to improvise anything that would change their lives. And they said, oh, what's that on the phone? There's a phone. I'll get it. I have what? Cancer? And then I hit. So my improv, I made fun of that. And halfway through, I became a mermaid. And I still think I got the most laughs than I've ever gotten in my life, even 105 years later. And he glared at me, and he drool was coming down his mouth, and he hated me. And he said, "That's not how you do the game." And then I that made me want to keep doing comedy as improv. And then, but anyway, yeah. Right after I got kicked out, as I was walking to the bus, the bus stop to take the long bus, then a subway, then a streetcar, then a bus to where I lived in the suburbs, to tell my mother, "You're right, I can't act." Bill Davis came and he said, no, you're good. I know they called you a one-legged actor. First of all, it's a good leg. Comedy is a good leg. And second of all, you're probably better than they think they're anyway. And then he had written down a piece of paper, the Second City. I guess you know this, but the people listening may not know this. Second City Workshop phone number. And that's how I got into comedy, really.
And that's where you met Dave Foley.
That's where I met Dave Foley. The first year... it was without Dave Foley. I was there for like 3 years. The last two was with Dave. The first was with Mike Myers. We were the only teenagers, and he was just so much better than me. He got like hired right away, and I'm accidentally a rebel, just like Jim Petty. I'm not really trying to be a rebel. I'm just like sort of an idiot, and I have to do things the way I do. So, but Dave was similar, and we immediately started the Kids in the Hall immediately, though it took a while to figure out the name.
We're talking with Kevin MacDonald here on Downtown. We've talked with Dave on the show. Bruce has been on with us a couple of times, but since he hasn't been on the show, I want to bring up the fact that you didn't think Mark McKenney was funny when you first saw him.
Right. I did not. He just looks like a normal guy. And we had heard, Dave and I and a guy named Luch, we were called the Kids in the Hall, and we were in Toronto, and we played a thing called Theater Sports, which is like, do you know what that is?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
People listening, do you know what that is? You improvise against another team and you get points, and I'm doing things with my hands. I don't know if people can see it, but it wouldn't help anyway, so they're okay. And then we heard in Calgary, where theater sports was invented by Keith Johnston, an improv guru, like him and Del Close, who are two improv gurus. There was a troupe like us called The Audience, where they also broke all the rules, and they were getting quite popular. And they were the biggest thing in Calgary, but it was Calgary. So they moved to Toronto, and we became like a boyfriend-girlfriend sketch comedy troupe. Sorry, or girlfriend-girlfriend-boyfriend-boyfriend. I'm not old. I'm old, but I'm not. What you kids are doing are wonderful. It's wonderful. Anyway, we became like lovers. I'll just say that, but in a comedy way. We were comedy lovers. And but I met them one by one. Bruce was so cool, and you knew that he was funny, but he was cool. I remember we were alone once, like in the first week of knowing each other. Like right away, the both troops knew we wanted to move together. Sorry, I mean, not move together, work together. I can't stop talking, but here I go. And to make conversation, I asked Bruce, what bands do you like? And he said, or like what musician, whatever I asked. And he said, I like Lou Reed, The Birthday Party, and of course, Iggy. And I thought, oh, this guy's too cool for me. And the other guys who later quit the Kids in Hall, they were very funny. But Mark just was like a normal looking guy. He's just like a normal looking guy. And I remember always making fun of him that he always asked for exact change. I said, what funny guy asked for exact change? Then the first, like a week later, we saw, we Kids in Hall saw The Audience from Calgary perform in Theater Sports. And he was brilliant. He was like character comedian brilliant. And once he got into a character, and now I know he's funny even without a character. Like he's brilliant. And he's sort of my favorite Kids in the Hall in a way. I guess I was a bad, I mean, I hadn't seen him, so I shouldn't have judged him, but he just didn't seem funny. I'm stopping to talk now for 7 seconds.
All right. In that 7 seconds, let me ask how, and you've talked about it before, but for our audience, how did the challenges so many of you guys had being the sons of alcoholics impact your approach to comedy and what became Kids in the Hall?
Yeah, I guess it's one of those invisible things that, of course, impacts you. You don't know that it's impacting you while it impacts you. But, sometimes obvious things happen, like we write scenes about being children of alcoholics. But the invisible thing is how it sort of hovers over our dark view of life. Our dark view, but hopeful. Because we were lucky. There's millions, billions, trillions of children of alcoholics. But we were funny. So we were sort of lucky that we had that tool. And we always speak of this, that like after something horrible happened with my dad, I'd go in my my bedroom and I'd think of something funny, or I would like be insulting him in my head, but jokes would, not that I write jokes, I just know what else to call them, but funny things would happen. And we sort of had that common bond, though there's this story, I'll, I'll tell a quick version. I'll tell without being in really dark. I'll just say, and then something dark happens. We were the five kids in the hall because Mark is not the child of an alcoholic. Right. He's the child of a diplomat, and he was well off, and he lived in Mexico and Jamaica and Paris and Washington, and but once when we were still young, struggling, a comedy troupe in the mid '80s, we had rented out a theater. To rehearse, we had a big show coming up, and the group before us was some Shakespearean group, and they hadn't finished. So to kill time, we were talking about our horrible dad stories. I won't tell them now. I do it on stage sometimes, and it tortures the audience. Very dark. Like Dave had a very dark story about his dad trying to set his mother on fire. I had my dark story about my dad trying to knowing that his liver was exploding, that he was about to throw up blood. He tried to do it on my head. Scott's dad tried to run him over. Bruce's dad forced him to, I guess I am telling you the story quicker versions. Bruce's dad, you can edit this, right? Bruce's dad forced him to drive when he was 10, and they crashed into a tree. And then it was Mark's turn to tell the story, and he got very dramatic. I thought, oh, what's coming? And he said, I'll never forget the time that my father fired my nanny in front of me. We said, what? That's your son? He said, it hurt. She was like a second mother. Yeah, yeah. And like I always say, I know the pain is relative. It hurt. But like he was the last guy. Like we opened for that. He should have been the opening act. And then we should end with throwing up blood on me.
What did those hundreds of shows you did at the Rivoli do for you guys?
Well, it made us a group. Like it made us, you know, because it did so many things. It got us the... There were five guys in the audience and three kids in the hall. We realized that we should have women, so we got three women. And so that, what's that in math? There's 12. There were 12 of us at one point, but and we all sort of had the same comedy. We came from the same comedy ballpark. We were in the same. The neat thing is that we sort of think the same way, but we complement each other. Except. Some of the guys did think the same, and just by chance it seemed, I didn't think this one was happening. This is something I think in retrospect, like Gary and Frank, who were brilliant, they got hired to write a TV show in Canada for CBC, so they quit. Luch, who was sort of my best friend, him and Dave, he just suffered from stage fright, and he was having a little trouble with some of the guys from Calgary, so he quit. And all the three women were discovered right away. Because women in comedy was so rare in the 80s. And so second, one by one, they got like hired by Second City. And it was whittled down to four of us, Mark and Bruce. And we weren't sure that we liked Bruce. And Dave wasn't sure he liked Mark. And Mark wasn't sure he liked the Dave. And everyone likes me. I don't know why. But we got the comedy chemistry. And then the show started getting better. But we were missing something. We were sort of like shy guys at that point, except for a little bit like Mark, not so much Mark, but we all loved our ideas. We thought we were good writers, but during our shows, we'd be sort of like in the back of the stage whispering them. And then Scott Thompson just forced his way into the troupe. And he was like the actor. He went to acting and he's in a big university, bigger than my little college. And he like graduated. So he literally forced us to the front of the stage. And even though four of us, I believe, are funnier than Scott, though I don't even know if that's true. We wouldn't have made it without him. He's just funny in a different way. Joey Ramone once said, I don't know, there's nobody in the world like Dee Dee Ramone. And I think that about Scott. So I think later they found out that Dee Dee suffered from mental illness.
No connection there at all. I know you can, because everybody in the group can do a Lorne Michaels impression.
Yes.
Could you share a bit of that with us?
You know, the thing about doing a Lorne impression, you're not really doing a Lorne impression. You're doing a Dana Carvey impersonated me, and everyone does a Dana Carvey impression. And that's the best I can do. And you know, the movie Brain Candy, Mark was doing Lorne Michaels' impression as Don Rorador, the bad guy. But Lorne Michaels to this day refuses to believe that it was a Lorne impression.
Well, since you brought up Brain Candy, did you guys think that was it after Brain Candy?
Yeah, that was that was it. It was over. Yeah, yeah. Very few, especially to that point, very few comedy troupes. Like even Key and Peele are brilliant. What they met in an audition, like a Mad TV, didn't they? And then we were friends first. And there's very few like real pure comedy troupes. Even Monty Python really like audition, but they knew each other in Oxford and Cambridge. You guys probably know all that. but there's very few comedy troupes. And so our Bible was Monty Python. So we thought we do a few stage things. We get to discovered for TV. We would do, we thought four seasons because they only did four seasons. We got a season more than Python. Then we would do a movie and it would be such a big hit that we would be able to do a movie every 3 or 4 years. And in between that, we'd have our separate adventures in our career. And then we'd, but the Brain Candy bombed. And we thought it was over. Nobody said, and Dave wasn't talking to us for a while. And he was an important part. And nobody said, I quit. Let's split up. But it was in the air. It seemed like that way. But what we didn't know, the secret thing that was happening was because nobody really watched us on HBO. People that watched us loved us, I guess. The critics liked this a lot. Nobody watched it. But then Lauren Michael sold Saturday Night Live repeats and Kids in the Hall repeats to Comedy Central. So for the 3 or 4 years after, and we had no idea, 3 or 4 years after Brain Candy bombed, we were finally getting our audience, the cult audience, the large cult audience. And then so 4 years later, we were friends again, and that was good. But our lawyer, because we didn't need a manager anymore because we didn't know we were a troupe, our old lawyer said, you know, there's a great demand for your touring. And then our comeback tour got us back together. We never really officially split up. So in a way, we're doing a B version of the Monty Python Bible. We do get together every 3 or 4 years. Sometimes it's a tour, sometimes it's a miniseries, sometimes it's a show on Amazon. Hopefully one day it'll be a movie. So we're doing a B version of that. I'm making all your nice little questions into long, long answers.
That's what we like here. Speaking of Brain Candy, and you know, you use the word bomb. Does the fact that it, I liked it from the first time I saw it. I really enjoyed it. Does the fact that it sort of did build that cult following at least remove some of the sting from you know, what at the time, as you just said, thought was an ending of the Kids in the Halls?
Did it build a cult following? Scott says that, but I don't really think it built a cult following. Really does. I mean, the people who liked it really like it, maybe even a little more than they did. They asked me to show it because I was doing stand up in Seattle a few months ago, and the audience went crazy over it. But it didn't. The one cult comedy I was in, or at least it was for a while. I can't say my real opinion. I'm on the radio. It's me. I ruined it. Who cares what it was? But another movie was sort of that became a cult. But so I know what it's like to be like a. I don't think Brain Candy. But prove me I'm wrong. Prove to me. Is there somewhere I can go online? Is under cult classics or see Brain Candy?
Well, maybe I'm mistaking the devote because the people I know that like it really really love it.
Yes, I say this: the people that love Brain Candy, look, hey.
Maybe that is a different.
That's what I was trying to say. Yeah. The people that saw it in Seattle, like really love, like the people that liked it originally, really really like. I always say this: who, as your first comedy movie, who does a comedy about depression? Like as your first movie, like you work your way to it. Yeah, like I think a career should be like the Beatles. I know I just said Monty Python. I'm stepping on my own. First you have I Want to Hold Your Hand, She Loves You, and fun songs, even though they're kind of complex for those kind of. And then you get better and you're doing Rubber Soul, then you're doing Sgt. Pepper. We jumped to Sgt. Pepper, which I think like Python's first movie was a sketch movie. Then Holy Grail was like a gag fest. Then Life of Brian was like a real movie in a way. Like they figured out how to do Life of Brian by doing it. And I do like Brain Candy. I like it a lot. But it would have been a lot better if it was our third movie, I think.
All right, well, so I don't know if it was your White Album or your Abbey Road, but we both love Death Comes to Town.
Thank you very much. I guess White Album, I think. Yeah, thank you.
It's thank brilliant. You and Marty is so wonderful. We think, and then we find out the truth about her.
Right, right. Good, so no one can guess it. That's good. Bruce was going to play Marnie, and I was going to play Ricky, the guy, be politically correct, the overweight guy. But you had to go in a suit, and I'm claustrophobic, so we had to trade parts. that's one thing I remember about it. I won't ruin the ending in case people haven't seen it, but I'm glad. I hope it surprised people.
And Sam, not the greatest public defender that we've ever seen in crime
shows. No. Yeah, that was a funny idea. We wrote it, and then we got Gary Campbell, one of the guys that I mentioned earlier. We got one of the Gary and Frank guys who quit to become a writer. He became quite a successful writer, so we got him to rewrite it with us. And it was his idea for me to, after my when I'm in trial, when I'm talking to the jury, my final thing that I say, and then at the end I accidentally say, "That's why, ladies and gentlemen, the jury, the defendant is guilty." You said guilty. No, I didn't. I said not guilty. I thought that was a really good idea. And the cat thing about that, is that his name, Sam? I don't even remember.
Yeah, Sam Murray, I think.
Yeah, that makes sense. Oh, Sam, who's a politician in Winnipeg.
Ah.
Anyway, I had a cat that I forced to live for a long time. I didn't want to die, and I spent $21,000. And the cat did live. Like, they thought he was going to die in 3 months, and he died in 2 years. And Dave Foley always sort of was mad at me for wasting money like that. And then so that we thought of the idea about the cat who is so sick, and I keep him alive, that he's so sick that he, which I think could have been a good sketch, that he teaches himself to speak English so he can say, "Kill me."
We love the, I guess we're going to call it the sixth season, not the new season, not the reboot.
That's what we do. Yeah, that's the hip thing to do.
It's so good, and I think what made it so great is that you guys fully owned being late 50s, early 60s, and didn't try to be what you were 30 years ago.
No, I mean, that's the thing. In a way, there's an argument to be made that we did it too much, but that's sort of what we're... We don't go around saying this, because then we'd be pompous and pretentious, and who would care about us? Just me examining us. We seem to be all about, don't tell the others I said this, because it seems like a pretend, all about the truth, be it good or be it bad. Sort of like John Lennon, like his first solo album was amazing, and it was agonizing to hear, and I can't hear it a lot, cause it's so agonizing, but it's sort of all about the truth. Now, luckily, we do comedy, so it comes about comedy. And we're also, I guess in a way, like they say about comedians, where they're funny in school because they to defend themselves against bullies. We know that we're old, and you're not going to get the same kids in the hall, appearance-wise, or even writing-wise, or energy-wise. So I guess, in a way, again, we didn't discuss this. It was unspoken. I guess we wanted to say it first. So there's a lot of stuff about us being our age. Mostly, I think it's all about the truth. As long as it's funny.
You've inspired me. I just turned 66 a couple days ago, and I'm going on the poll. I am going to do it. I'm trying a new career. I think it can work.
Good. Then we did a little good with that sketch.
Yeah,
that's good.
Yeah, no question about it. You have done so much work on your own as well. Great role and a recurring role on that 70s show, and so much voiceover work through the years, Lilo and Stitch and so many others. But I think I saw an interview where you said all of that voiceover work, you have one voice. You have the Kevin MacDonald voice.
Yeah. Like I work with some of the best, like, you know, Billy West. He was sort of, for the past 20 or 30 years, he's been considered the best. He is that cliche, the man of a million voices. He can do a million voices. He can do impressions. He can do any kind of, you could hire him for anything and he could do it. I am the man of one voice. I am the man of one voice. This is it. I can do the voice. And I could still sort of go high pitched, you know, in New Orleans. Am I pronouncing it right?
Yeah.
The guy who was in the improv troupe, what's his name? Nick, nice guy, sweetheart. He drove me around a lot, and he said someone in his improv troupe asked if my voice was still high, like Pleakley and Lilo and Stitch, and he said no, got lowered. And I said wait a second, and then I pretended to do a comedy rant, and I worked it up until it's that, like, I kept getting more angrier and angrier and angrier until like I got high again. And I said, and you know what? I always had to do that. If I just start high, I'm doing one of those fake falsetto things. But if I, anyway, I'm boring myself. Good night.
What's the status of your rock opera, Kevin?
Well, I do it all the time. I just did it in Norfolk, I don't know how you pronounce it, Virginia. And it went over better than it ever. I mean, it always goes over well. I didn't try. I wanted to try to get it on off Broadway, so we did it in New York with some celebrity friends, and I didn't invite anyone off Broadway because Because this is the trouble that is me. My dad, the drunk, was a salesman, and he was a good salesman. He won like the Chicago Cup, which was the Super Bowl of or the MVP, NHL MVP, like 3 years running. And he always like sold too much. And I like we went to a restaurant and he didn't like the table. He always talked the person into getting us the best table or the best seats in a movie or the best room in a hotel. And I hated that. It's embarrassed. So the last second, I didn't ask anyone to come and see it. Now I'm just hoping word of mouth helps me. But I do every now and then the rock opera. I like it. Of course, I enjoy it. I'm not really a songwriter. But Dave Foley says I have a gift for melody, and I just learned enough chords on my guitar. I'm not going to show the guitar. No, they're just listening to this. My guitar is over there. I'm pointing to my left. I just enough chords to write songs, and it is a true story, and there's the middle part of the true story that no one's walked out of yet. So I always make sure Kids in the Hall fans come to that one. Then I'll know it'll be more forgiving. If I ever played it to an audience who didn't know who I was. I don't know how the middle part of the rock opera would go over.
Well, you talked about guys getting together every few years. What do you think it will be next? Another live tour, a movie, more episodes?
I'm nodding, and you gave me three options, and I'm nodding.
Well, all of them.
In a way, that's true. We're talking. We have Zooms. I had an email from them. When are we going to Zoom this week? For a second, it seemed like it was going to be a tour. Now it may still be a tour, but then one of us thought about like a low budget movie. We have lots of energy. I'm petting my cat. We have a lot of excitement about. She's used to my high voice. A lot of excitement about the last series. Then like it wasn't super awful, and we still seem like we can be like us. So we want to do something. Right now, the odds on favorite may be a tour, but there's also some talk of maybe. Doing a really low budget movie that we can do whatever we want in it, and then when it bombs, it won't bomb so badly because it'll be for even less money.
Well,
but we're definitely talking. We're definitely going to do something.
We look forward to whatever it is. I'm so excited to see you out on the road, not telling jokes, telling stories. The City Winery Tour, July 17th in Boston, New York, Philadelphia, on the docket as well. Kevin, we've loved your work for so long. Great to have the chance to talk with you. And now that we've got three of the five kids that we've had on the show. I'm not going to say it to Bruce. I'm not going to say it to Dave, but you're obviously our favorite already.
Thank you for lying.
That's what Gary does. Thanks again, Kevin. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I had fun in the interview. I'm not lying this time. Bye.